It was August 2005, outside of a pub in London's East End, when a man called Robert Darby was found lying on the ground with a stab wound to the chest. He was taken by an ambulance to the Royal London Hospital, but died there the following day. It took 8 years to convict someone for Robert Darby's murder, and that man's name is Jason Moore. But he has always insisted that he didn't do it, that it was a fix-up.
I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. I think they fabricate evidence to suit their narrative.
That's Kirsty Moore, Jason's sister.
It's wrong. It's morally wrong on every level.
We're taught to believe that our justice system is fair, that everyone is equal in the eyes of the law, and that it's almost impossible for an innocent person to go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. Because the alternative is just too awful to imagine. These are the stories of people who maintain their innocence and yet remain in prison, fighting unimaginable odds to win justice in a system that, many would say, is rigged against them. This podcast tells the stories of those on the outside fighting to free those on the inside. I'm Arnie Duke, and this is The Overturn. It's March 2025, and I'm on my way to Poplar, East London, to meet Kirsty Moore at a local pub. She's sitting outside when I arrive, and as we say hello, a number of people come over to chat to her. They ask how the campaign is going, the Free Jason Moore campaign, that is, that Kirsty is running to try and get her brother out of jail and clear his name. Everyone who passes the pub seems to know her. She seems like a bit of a local hero. Just as we head in, Kirsty points to the Docklands skyline in front of us and says,
"If you just look across there, right at the bottom of that tower is where Jason used to live. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. When I go over there, I just find it really sad."
It's an old school East London pub. We sit down on the electric blue leather sofa next to a red-topped pool table. There's gold strings of confetti hanging down from the ceiling and framed pictures of Hollywood stars on the walls. The room looks like it hasn't changed in years. It reminds me of a different time. I ask Kirsty why she asked to meet me here.
And there has a degree of nostalgia around it, I suppose. Family connections to the area, that kind of thing. Jason lived over the road when this first happened. So the campaign is started here. So yeah, victims' family live stone's throw from here. So it's all around the East End.
Kirsty says as kids, they were raised to trust the police. Now in her 50s, that's no longer the case. What was your impression of the criminal justice system at the time? Did you trust it?
Absolutely. Complete trust in the system. I mean, driving down the motorway and there's a police car behind you. You see them as an authority. You see them as holding law and order correctly. I remember my dad said to me once, "If you ever have any problems and you don't know what to do, find your way to the nearest police station." You know, because they are some, you know, because you're built up to trust the police. They're there to help you. That's what they're there to do.
But 20 years ago, that all changed. Kirsty struggles a bit remembering the details. How old was Jason at the time?
Well, I was 40. I think Jason was 42, mm-hmm. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Even that, it's what it does to you. You just wipe it out of your mind because it's just like, can't hold on to thinking that way. You can't wake up in the morning and say, look, he's lost 13 years of his life, because that's your life as well, you know? And it's really upsetting to think of it like that.
In 2005, a man called Robert Darby was stabbed outside a pub in London's East End. Kirsty says that Jason was in a car nearby when it happened. And so, when he and his parents were called in for questioning by the police, they assumed it would be to assist the officers in their investigation. Except by Kirsty's account, it was less questioning and more an exercise in intimidation.
The police told my parents that the Darby family were a violent East End criminal family. They said that they wanted to speak to Jason for questioning. As they knew he, they actually said to my dad, look, we know he played no part in it, but we just want to speak to him. He may have details that can help us with our inquiry. And my dad said to them, well, after everything you've just said about this violent criminal family, can you protect him, I suppose is the word. And they said no. And while we're at it, we can't protect you either.
Kirsty says the family were so afraid of the Darbys that they left the country.
Eventually, my parents sold their property and then moved abroad. And my younger sister also went abroad. My parents have since come back, they stayed away for many years.
And that is because of?
Yeah, because of what the police said.
What were you afraid of?
What was I afraid of? I was afraid of that they were going to do me some real harm. And my family. Because that's what the police said they were. They said they were violent, East End criminal family. Jason left, as my parents did, as my sister did, because of that fear. And we all hoped that the police would do their job properly and that that would only be a short-term thing. And it went on for 8 years.
But Jason struggled living abroad away from family. So after 8 years, he returned to the UK to reunite with them.
Because it was becoming very apparent that the police had just shelved this case and had no interest whatsoever into solving it properly. And I think all of us felt that, you know, enough is enough. And Jason came back to assist the police with their questioning. Just had enough. And that's what happened. He got in touch with his solicitor and made an appointment to go and help the police with their inquiries. Well, he went, he did a 3.5-4 hour interview with them, answered their questions to the best that he could. He left and that was it. He just left. And then next thing you know, he's been charged with murder.
To this day, there is no forensic evidence that has ever linked Jason Moore to the crime. The only eyewitnesses told police the killer was between 5'10" and 6', with a shaved number 2 haircut. Jason, on the other hand, is a kind of Elvis lookalike, with thick tousled hair, olive skin, and most notably, stands at a towering 6'5". Back in 2005, in the days after the murder, a witness had bypassed Jason in an identity parade. But years later, on Jason's return to the UK, the same witness was asked to look again and pick Jason out of a police photo ID parade that only showed his head and shoulders, masking his distinctive height. Kirsty emphasises how unlikely it is that 8 years on, this witness would have a clearer sense of what the stabber looked like than when the crime first happened. But this was the only evidence linking Jason to the crime, for which he is currently serving a life sentence. One man's word against his. But last year, this very same eyewitness revealed to an investigative journalist that he was drunk when it all happened. And what sentence was he given?
18 years recommended. Life sentence. Yeah.
What were you thinking then when you heard that, when you first found that out?
I was just trying to breathe. Because I guess it's like being a rabbit in the headlights, just completely stunned. So you're not actually thinking. You're just trying to make sense of what you just heard. There's no thought to it. You're just stunned. And I was just trying to breathe.
And could you see Jason?
Yeah, I was looking down at Jason. In fact, there was one point where I stood up, because like you're up in the rafters and you're looking over like you see in the movies. And I was looking over and I remember I shouted, "Jason, look at me." Because you could see his whole being was just incomplete. He was like disbelief. It was like he'd been shot with a stun gun. I just couldn't believe it. Always imagined it must be what it feels like to be shot. You can feel it, but you can't comprehend it. The only thing you're thinking about at that point is Jason. Where have they taken him? What has he got? Has he got what he needs? How can I get to see him? That's all you care about. You don't care about all the system and everything. You care about that person. That's your, you know, that's your brother. And you've just seen what happened to him, and that's what you care about. That's all I cared about. I just had to get to the solicitor, find out where they'd taken him. In this case, it was Belmarsh. This is where you start getting into the prison system, because you'd now got to learn how to get a visit. Who's going to go on the visit? Who's the best person to go on the visit for Jason? Not for yourself. It's all about Jason. It's not about anybody else. Can you send him anything? What about his clothes? What about this? What, you know, all that kind, those kind of questions. The next thing is your parents. You know, my sister. My mum was having a really difficult time at the time, going up to the trial, and my sister thought it was better for her to be with her at the time. So that's what we did. So I had to come out of the court and call my parents. They couldn't manage to be there. I didn't want them to be there. You don't want your parents witnessing that. No. And Jason was firm on that as well. And so you literally, still not thinking about yourself, come out of the Old Bailey, find a quiet spot. And you've then got to sort of compose yourself enough to go on the phone, relay what's happened in as much detail as you can. But you've also got to be mindful of them without cracking up, basically.
Kirsty was just about to build herself up to make that call when a car pulled up in front of her.
And big bald-headed guy got out, walked around the back of the car, and he said, "Are you Kirsty?" I said, "What?" And I recognised him. And he was sitting in the court the whole time. He was one of the Darby brothers.
Tim Darby, the brother of the man who had been stabbed, who Kirsty's brother had just been convicted of murdering. This is the family that the police told Kirsty were dangerous, that were out to get them. But before she had time to panic, Tim said something unexpected.
"We know your brother didn't do that." I said, "What?" He said, "We know your brother didn't do that. And as for all that other shit, we didn't do none of that either. We don't do that."
She's talking about her parents' questioning by the police, when she says that officers told them that the Darbys were a dangerous, violent family that were out to get them.
"Why don't you tell them in there? Why didn't you tell them in there?" I was saying to him. He said, "Look, what's gone on here? Nah. Not down to us. That was them that did that to your family." He said, "And we know your brother haven't done this. Take my number." And that was when the Darby family joined this campaign outside the Old Bailey.
And why do you think he believed so wholeheartedly that Jason didn't do it?
Because the police had told him. It was one of the reasons. And they had other reasons.
The police had told him what?
That the co-defendant was the perpetrator, not Jason Moore.
So you're saying that there's been a cover-up by the police?
It would point to that, wouldn't it?
The Metropolitan Police Service did not respond to a request for comment. Five people went to Jason's appeal, all swearing under oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. One of those people was Tim Darby, the brother of the victim. He stood up in court and testified that Jason Moore was not the man who killed his brother. But the appeal judges dismissed their evidence. After an appeal is rejected, the only other possible route to overturning a conviction is the Criminal Cases Review Commission, or CCRC. It's an independent body that investigates potential miscarriages of justice, set up after the wrongful conviction of the Birmingham Six, to ensure that something similar could never happen again. To apply to the CCRC, you need to find new evidence which would suggest that the conviction could be unsafe. If there was any chance of seeing Jason walk free, Kirsty had a big challenge ahead of her. So, with no experience or understanding of what lay ahead, she put on her detective hat and started digging for evidence which could clear Jason's name.
And now you've got to try and read the paperwork. And what I mean by that is, like, when the police do an investigation, everything has a number and is relevant to another number, and it's like a puzzle. Now I've got to start putting it all back together again and get your own head around it. Or you just got to try and make sense of it all, because, like, you're just, like, just chucked in the deep end and you don't know what to do, because what do you do? You're thinking, oh, look, I can go through this paperwork, but what do I know about this paperwork? What do I know about the courts? What do I know about the way it works? What, even if I found something, what do I do with it? You know, that kind of thing. The lawyers move on. They've got, you know, money to earn and run a business or whatever they're doing. They've got court cases for other people. So you get those little bits of information from them. No, because it's this, and no, because it's that. No, you can't use that because it's this. So you get all these conversations. What about this? And what about that? No, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. If it's already been heard, you can't use it. You know what I mean? And that's the thing you have to get in your head. If it's been heard in the trial, you can't use it. I've now got to read the transcripts and relive that whole thing again. And I tell you what, over the years, one of the things I really, really struggled with was names. Because I had these people's names in my head every day for years. And these people had done this to my family. My parents are in bits. My brother's in bits. Whole family just in absolute living turmoil.
Jason's first application to the CCRC was rejected. But since last year, when the witness admitted to being drunk when he saw the stabbing take place, they've submitted a second. Jason's case has been under review for well over 2 years now. Kirsty says that months have gone by in which the CCRC could have spoken to the witness, every day of which Jason's life is passing by in jail. How's Jason doing?
No, he's not doing well. It's in a very bad place. Well, it wears you down. It wears you down. A prime example, we were supposed to have had a response from the CCRC Monday just gone, and we're still sitting here with no response. And that's what they do. They drag their feet. They make you wait months and months. You don't know what's going on. They're supposed to work with you. They don't work with you. So I don't know if they're looking out for themselves, because I don't think they're trying to assist us. I think because the Criminal Case Review Commission is under such scrutiny and the magnifying glass is on them, I think they're trying to sort of create to settle the public's opinion of them. But the fact is, no, it doesn't work that way, because what they're doing to these people, and they seem to forget there's an innocent man sitting in prison. So it doesn't take 16 months to knock on somebody's door. It's wrong. It's morally wrong on every level.
How often do you get to see Jason these days?
Well, over the past couple of months, I saw him in January, but because obviously all this is going on, but for the first 11 years, I used to see him once a week. And what they did, they put him so far away that it takes 4.5 hours to get there. And the expense as well, train tickets on. He's up in Wolverhampton. It's like 90 quid a ticket to get there. It's a lot of money to find.
You look a bit emotional.
Pretty angry, actually. The more I talk about the Criminal Case Review Commission, I just get so angry with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they just, it's just not what they're selling. And I get really angry because, you know, Jason's not the only one. There's so many other people sitting in prison, innocent. And it just, it's alarming.
Absolutely alarming.
Kirsty says she has someone she wants me to meet. So we drive about 15 minutes down the road to Stepney.
I'm Joanne Grenfell. I'm the Bishop of Stepney in the Church of England in the Diocese of London.
Bishop Joanne has become Kirsty's co-campaigner, so to speak. She greets us at the door with two small dogs scurrying around her ankles.
How common is it then for a member of the Church of England to get involved in a criminal justice case?
I guess it's not that common, but probably the principles there that any clergy person or bishop would care about the people who are in there on their patch in their parish, and that the Church of England's there for everybody. You don't have to go to church to, you know, to be a parishioner. People can just show up and it's everybody's church, and that really matters to me. That's why I'm part of the Church of England. But in terms of criminal justice in particular, it wasn't something I'd hugely thought about previously. I was, you know, aware, I read the papers, but it was an email from Kirsty, and then, you know, she landed on my doorstep, and here I am. I know a whole lot more about it now than I did 2 years ago.
Kirsty had been experiencing a lot of setbacks at the time. Radio silence from MPs and local councillors before she contacted Bishop Joanne.
I got my former PA, Ellie, to read it because she's studying criminology. And she read it and she went, Joanne, you've got to read this. You've got to read it. So I did. And then when they arrived on the doorstep, I kind of thought, you know, what are they going to want me to do? But they were just, I mean, Kirsty's a force of nature. And I tell you, if I ever get stuck in prison for something I didn't do, I want Kirsty to be my campaign manager. She's just got this like insuppressible determination to do the right thing for her brother. And she sat here in the seat where I'm sitting, you know, with the others, and said, this is why it matters. And the fact that the victim's brother came too, I just thought that was extraordinary. And he was sitting there saying, I know Jason Moore didn't do this. And it's not justice for my brother if the wrong man's inside. And basically, you know, we live in your patch. We're from around here. You're our bishop. Will you help us? And then it went from there.
You know, before Kirsty came to you with this case, what was your understanding of the law, the legal system, and how has it transformed since you met Kirsty?
I think I'm fundamentally someone who trusts institutions, who thinks that people try to do the right thing. I didn't have any reason to mistrust the criminal justice system. I was aware of the case of Andrew Malkinson and his you know, wrongful conviction and how that was overturned. So that was one case that had got sort of breakthrough for me, but I didn't have any reason to be thinking that I didn't trust the police or the you know, the legal process or judicial process or anything like that. And the more I've read of Jason's case, and then other things, I've been drawn into an all-party parliamentary commission on justice issues and wrongful conviction, particularly around joint enterprise. The more I've read, the more I'm really appalled that really poor decisions are sometimes made, that the system is really badly underfunded, so that it's incredibly slow, and you know, justice delayed is justice denied. This is Jason's life that's passing by as he sits in prison.
And so Bishop Joanne visits her local prison, Pentonville, quite often. But visiting Jason, she says, was different.
It was different because I'd heard so much about him, and I'd seen pictures of him, and I'd read all about him, but never actually met the person. And so, yeah, we got the train up to his prison, not too far from Wolverhampton. And I mean, I was really glad to meet him. He's a really lovely guy. He's a gentle giant of a guy. But with the emphasis on the giant, I mean, he is enormous. He's 6'6". So I'm quite tall. I'm 5'8", but he absolutely dwarfs me. So when you look at the evidence and the eyewitness evidence that says that the man that did the killing was a little bit bigger than me. Well, Jason is not a little bit bigger than me. He's a whole load bigger than me. And he's a broad man with big black hair. You know, there's a lot of him in all ways. And you couldn't possibly confuse him for someone who's, I don't know, 5'10", thin-faced and with sort of mousy thin hair. That's just not Jason. So seeing him was lovely at a personal level, but at an evidence level, it was absolutely shocking. He's not the man described.
For Kirsty, Bishop Joanne has provided invaluable support to the campaign.
I mean, it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't take me to do that.
But that is the truth of it, because he is in prison. He doesn't have access to anything, you know? So to know, I think to know that Bishop Joanne is his voice, mm-hmm. it means in his mind that there's a chance that we might get there and get these people to actually listen.
I think you're really downplaying, Kirsty, what you do. You've done a ton of stuff for Jason. You've been his voice for over 10 years now. Unless you've got a Kirsty, you've not got a hope. because it looks to me like a full-time job, a kind of campaign manager job with all those skills that you need to develop and other people whose skills you need to draw in. And I worry about the impact that has on you. I think it's a huge long-term burden. It's partly living Jason's life for him during that time because he can't get out of prison to do it. And so his concerns become yours. That's an intolerable burden for a sibling, for a relative, for a friend. And there's so little support. I think I've learned how lonely it is for you to do this. I think it's what you've just described.
Frustrated at the CCRC's lack of action since our meeting, Bishop Joanne tried to contact the witness, the one who, in 2023, revealed to an investigative journalist that he was drunk when it all happened. She found him at home after simply knocking on his front door twice. Last year, Jason Moore spent his 12th Christmas behind bars. He refuses to ring his family on the day for fear of ruining it for them. They're having no fun anyway because of the guilt they feel for enjoying themselves in his absence. The campaign to quash Jason's conviction has been gaining momentum. Having the victim's brother on side sends a pretty powerful message. 12 Christmases mark 2/3 of Jason's minimum sentence, but parole boards rarely look favourably on prisoners who won't express remorse for their crime. Jason insists he will never confess to a crime he did not commit. This makes it unlikely he'll be released. In the next episode, I speak to a man who spent 28 years in prison and find out what it finally took to clear his name.
I slept on the floor in protest for 28 years.
A CCRC spokesperson said, "We have received an application in relation to this case and a review is underway. We have made repeated efforts to contact all relevant parties. These efforts will continue. It would be inappropriate for us to discuss the application further at this stage." This series is a production of the Future Justice Project. It's produced and presented by me, Marnie Duke. Executive producers are John Robbins and Callum McRae.